This is The Intersection. My name is Mark Rowland. It's the intersection of politics and culture. Glad you're with us. Thank you so much for tuning in to this podcast. Our first segment today in our latest episode deals with the man in the middle, former Vice President Joe Biden. The conventional wisdom is, and he's done little to deny it, that he will next month announce that he's running for the presidency. It certainly would not be the first time, but he's throwing his hat in the ring. For some, he's going to be the great moderate centrist hope, very popular among folk in the Democratic Party who think that the party has gone too far left. Now, that's a conundrum in and of itself, because the party certainly would not have gone left unless they had elected people who had gone left. But that's another discussion for another day. He's extremely popular among those moderates and against the candidacies of uber progressives, people like Cory Booker, Bernie Sanders, Kamala Harris, and others. Joe Biden could be a breath of fresh air. He's also, I think, the favorite of the Democratic Party Brahmins, who've been looking at this leftward lurch in the party with a little bit of anguish, trepidation, nervousness, however you want to describe it. Now, one thing that Joe Biden has in common with everybody else who's running for the presidency, including the incumbent, I might add, there are skeletons in the proverbial closet. One, and let's start out with this one, people have said for a long time, especially when Joe Biden was vice president, that he had, a mouth that tended to toward slips of the lip. I don't have to go over them here, but they say he was sort of gaffe-prone in terms of some of the things he used to say. Now, we now have a president who is seemingly terminally gaffe-prone, but people don't look at what he says as gaffes necessarily. His base certainly doesn't. And Joe Biden is certainly no worse than the incumbent we have in office at this point. But there are other problems. And because Joe Biden has been in public life longer than most of the other candidates, he's got a longer list of things that people either in the Republican Party, should he win the nomination, or the Democratic Party during the primary season could theoretically and probably will harp on. For example, there's the plagiarism scandal of 1988. 1988, that's like 31 years ago already. But it's not going to go away. He clips some quotes from a British politician. Then there's the Anita Hill matter from 1991. Biden, at the time, was chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee. And he sort of lost the plot during the Clarence Thomas Supreme Court confirmation hearings. What's interesting is that they don't really, and I'm talking when I say they, I'm talking about history, doesn't really badmouth what Joe Biden himself said. But what they do take him to task for is the fact that as chair of the committee, he didn't rein in some other people who acted in a blatantly, and I emphasize blatantly, sexist manner toward Professor Anita Hill. Now, they did so because they wanted desperately to get Clarence Thomas confirmed as a Supreme Court justice, and they were successful just like they were successful with Brett Kavanaugh. But the fact of the matter is, there were people who really thought that Joe Biden could have done better in 1991. And of course, hindsight is 20/20 vision. It's difficult to measure a person's conduct from 25, 28 years, 29 years ago against what measurable norms we have today. It's difficult to say Joe Biden could have done more. And by the way, he has apologized for his conduct during those committee hearings, his conduct specifically toward Professor Anita Hill, who I assume feels vindicated further down the road as a result of the Me Too movement and a lot of other things that are aimed at empowering women that did not exist when she was raked over the coals by a committee that was composed solely of white men. Need to emphasize that fact. Solely of white men. Now, this footage, and there's plenty of footage of Joe Biden conducting those hearings, that footage is going to come back to haunt people. And it's going to come back, first of all, brought by people who don't want to see Joe Biden become president, but it's going to come back to haunt him. And there is not, among most of the other candidates, that kind of televised history. That stuff was on C-SPAN at the time. There's not that kind of book on Cory Booker or Kamala Harris. They're less tangible criticisms that people are making of their record. This has been around for a long time with Joe Biden. The plagiarism scandal, around for a long time with Joe Biden. How hard will progressives come at him when it comes to trying to sort out who is going to be the Democratic presidential nominee? My guess is they come at him hard. Ironically enough, one of the people who might be the biggest impediment here is a guy who ironically is the same age or very close to the same age as Joe Biden. That would be Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders is arguably a much more progressive candidate than Joe Biden. I would hate to see the two of them arguing about this stuff, though. But that is a very real possibility. The risk here for the Democratic Party is great. If they can't get their act together, whether it's Joe Biden or anybody else, if they can't get their act together and unite behind a single candidate, there will be a problem. It will be a problem that will reelect the incumbent president, something no Democrat that I know of wants to see happen. But we saw in 2016 what happened when Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, despite Bernie Sanders conceding that Hillary Clinton had the nomination and he was going to support her, et cetera, et cetera, I went and knocked on doors for Hillary Clinton in 2016. And the disparity between, and I'm talking now in predominantly black neighborhoods, but the disparity between young and old was startling to me. Not unexpected necessarily, but startling. You would go to certain places in Philly and knock on a door, and a woman, 50s, early 60s, would answer. You say, "We hope you come out." "Oh, man, I love Hillary. She's great." Then you go to some other neighborhoods, knock on doors. And, for example, there was a guy, African-American, who was renovating a building in, I believe it was West Philly. And, you know, came downstairs and was ready to engage in conversation about Bernie versus Hillary. Now, mind you, this was September, so Bernie was out of the picture by then. But I got a sense in talking to him and some other younger people in Philadelphia that there was this hesitancy to vote for Hillary Clinton. And the term I heard more often than any other in discussing her candidacy was, "I don't trust her." You see, and that, I think, helped to ruin her candidacy. I think, too, if there's this kind of schism, in this case, it may not be an age or generational thing. It could well be a schism between the moderates and the, quote, leftists. Because right now, the Republican Party is using the leftward shift of the Democrats to indicate to middle America that these people are going to destroy what you believe in. That's what they're saying to middle America. Not all people in middle America buy it, but certainly the incumbents' supporters do. They hear people talking about socialism this and socialized medicine that and this and that and that. And it's like lighting a fire under them, because to them, it would destroy the America that they had come to know and love. Never mind it's not true. Never mind that the country has gone through leftward lurches, rightward lurches, and still survived. The bottom line is, when you play to that fear, you always have a puncher's chance of winning a boxing match. And right now, my fear is that progressives will jump on Joe Biden and point out all his foibles. And I mean, that's part of campaigning. I'm not saying you can't do that. But I believe that it's going to get ugly among the candidates that are out here. And, you know, there's already been a little name-calling and mudslinging. And, God, I suddenly realized I've been talking about all this and didn't even mention Elizabeth Warren, who has announced she's running. So there are a lot of people in this fight. And who's going to win is an interesting question. And I would hope at some juncture, if Joe Biden wins, Joe Biden wins. As long as it's not a process where anyone, and I do mean anyone or any organization, puts their thumb on the scales. Because I do believe, despite the fact that I went out and knocked on doors for Hillary, I do think that there were elements of the Democratic Party that put their thumb on the scale for Hillary and against Bernie Sanders. There, I said it. And I think that that kind of repetition, if it were to happen again, you will turn off an entire generation of voters to your cause and to your party. And just when the party is starting to elect some really, really smart people, in some cases, brilliant people to office, and the ones that you're hearing the most about that are getting the slings and arrows of outrageous geeks, those are the very ones that will lead this country to something better. But that's another discussion, again, for another day. I'm not really here to harp on, you know, who is the future of the Democratic Party. Because right now, we got an election next year. And I hope we're prepared to talk about the present of the Democratic Party. No one, and I think this is the crux of the problem. There is no Democratic, honest arbiter of the schisms within the party. No one that progressives respect and moderates respect who can say, all right, now we're going to sit down here and knock a few heads and we're going to come up with some solutions to some of the problems that we're arguing about so that we have a united front going forward to win the presidency back to the Democratic Party. That's what's needed, an honest broker. You know, I remember when there were people who looked at what was going on in the Middle East. And the first thing they said was, you want an honest broker? Get us Nelson Mandela. He can broker a peace in the Middle East. Unfortunately, he never had the opportunity to do so. And I'm not sure the American government, past, present, or future, is really of a mind to have a man of the stature of Nelson Mandela negotiate in the Middle East. Well, we need somebody in the Democratic Party, somebody of stature, who can bring people together and say, okay, we're going to, look, we can fight, we can argue, we can debate, we can do all that stuff. But when it's done and it was an honest process, we're going to move forward with whoever ends up winning the nomination. Now, that doesn't mean that there isn't electoral reform that desperately, and I emphasize desperately, needs to happen so that there is, in fact, a level playing field. This whole thing about superdelegates and a lot of this other stuff is stuff that really does have to get hashed out. The Democratic Party is going to also have to, at one point or another, take a hard and fast position on the Electoral College, something that individual candidates have talked about back and forth, but it's not been a central plank of the Democratic Party platform. Do you get rid of it or do you not? It's not up to me to decide. If I, you know, in my heart of hearts, first blush, initial impression, get rid of it. It's an anachronism. It's something that bestows power where it shouldn't be bestowed. But that's, again, not for me to say. Who was that, Johnny Mathis? I don't know. We have to become focused. And it's not that long, folks. It's less than 2 years away, this election. And we have, unless we want another, now maybe there's people that are perfectly comfortable, progressives who are perfectly comfortable with another 4 years of Donald Trump. I don't know how they could be. I don't know how they could call themselves progressive, but maybe there are people like that in the universe. I do not happen to be one of them. But see, my thing is, you know, you can caricature the guy, you can talk trash about the guy all you want. My thing is, beat him. Never mind trashing him, beat him. See, because at the end of the day, that's what counts. You know, you can make faces about him. You can say he's this, he's that, he's lied 10 million times. You can do all of that. And he could still win re-election. That is frightening in this early 21st century America, that a guy who could lie like that so often and without any compunction whatsoever could actually be in line for a second. It boggles the mind. But to me, the way, and I, this is just simply from my own personal experience with competition. The way you beat somebody is to be better than they are. And by what I mean by that is to beat them at their game and to play yours. Thank you so much for listening to the podcast. Send me an email at mark@markreillymedia.com. If you've got a topic you want me to cover, email me at mark@markreillymedia.com. We're going to be back in a flash. We're going to talk about Paul Manafort.
Join the conversation at Mark Reilly Media on Facebook.
Welcome back to The Intersection. My name is Mark Reilly. Thank you so much for being here. Love to hear from you on my Facebook page, Mark Reilly Media. Please don't be shy. So now it's time to talk about Paul Manafort. For those of you who may have forgotten, he was Donald Trump's campaign chair for part of 2016. He's been part of Washington's permafrost for decades. What do I mean by permafrost? And I was having this conversation with a friend who, by the way, is a conservative guy, but I was having this conversation the other night. And to me, permafrost in Washington is a situation where you have the people at the top, the president, the vice president, cabinet officers, all that's the ice. But underneath the ice is the permafrost, the people who are there no matter what. Just like if the ice melts during the summer, the permafrost doesn't melt. The permafrost stays in place. Paul Manafort was part of that permafrost. He was part of that layer of operatives, lobbyists, and hangers-on who make real good livings by their proximity and access to power. And I got to tell you, I believe, whether you support Donald Trump or not, if you're a middle American struggling to make ends meet, and if you truly knew how Washington operated with all these people, these lobbyists, these hangers-on, these operatives who really don't care who the president is, their job is to maintain their lifestyle by being close to power, whatever that means. That's what I mean by permafrost. And I think that most of middle America would rise up in anger if they knew how many people are actually part of that permafrost. Well, Paul Manafort has been around for decades. He's like 70 years old almost. It's not like he got in the game last week. And as it turns out, he's been convicted on a raft of fraud charges, including the evasion of $6 million in taxes. He used his ill-gotten gains to, among other things, buy what has to be, and this is just my own, you know, I'm not a slave to fashion, but I saw a picture of this thing, I thought to myself, what is with this guy? It is the ugliest ostrich skin coat ever made, or one of the ugliest, if not the ugliest. He has lived the lifestyle every D.C. grifter dreams of. Dreams of. Nice dinners in beautiful restaurants, a fancy house, a lovely wife, a family. This is what these guys maneuver themselves in the position to do. And he latched on to Donald Trump. He could have latched on to somebody else, but he latched on to Donald Trump. And now for his various and sundry sins, which I'm not going to go into great detail about here, he is sentenced to 47 months in prison, which is just under 4 years. Now, for those of you who keep track of these things, federal sentencing guidelines mandated 19.5 to 24 years. Years, not months. He was sentenced to 47 months. He should, if you take the guidelines seriously, he should have been sentenced to 20 years. This has, of course, provoked a firestorm of criticism about the sentencing, about sentencing inequities, and about the light sentences that are oftentimes given out to white-collar criminals. And it really is something that you have to step back and think about and contemplate to understand, and to understand the gravity of all this. It's significant to me that the judge in this case, T.S. Ellis, doubled down on the sentence, saying that other than the crimes he committed, Paul Manafort led a blameless life. I repeat, a blameless life. Now, how this guy Ellis would know that is beyond me. Maybe they played cards or, you know, played a few rounds of golf. I don't know. But have any of you ever heard of the term judge shopping? Happens all the time. Happens in many cases when you're dealing with white collar criminals, okay? Because poor people can't judge shop all that well, or all that much for that matter. You know, you're facing a beef for shoplifting, you're gonna get the judge they tell you you get. Well, white collar criminals have a slightly different, white collar and well-to-do criminals, or alleged criminals, have a different way of functioning in the criminal justice system. What they do is get a really, really good lawyer. And what they say to the lawyer is, find me a judge who is relatively sympathetic to me, to who I am, and the case that I am dealing with here. Now, T.S. Ellis couldn't have unilaterally tossed the charges. I mean, maybe he could have, but he probably wouldn't have been on the bench for 5 minutes. But he has been publicly critical of mandatory minimum sentences. Mandatory minimum sentences are when you're convicted of a particular crime and under federal guidelines, you are to serve X amount of time to X amount of time, 8 to 25, 8 to 13, 8 to 15, whatever it is. That's mandatory minimums. And in Manafort's case, the mandatory minimum was 20 to 24 years. He got 47 months. I want to keep emphasizing that. I know you think I'm being redundant, but I keep emphasizing that because it really just puts a huge magnifying glass on inequities within the criminal justice system. There's just no way you can avoid that. There's no way you could justify putting some black kid from the Bronx in jail without, by the way, being convicted of anything for a period of time. We'll get into that in a minute. And give Paul Manafort 47 months, which, by the way, he may not do that whole time. A, he could get pardoned by Trump, but B, with everything else taken into consideration, he could be out in as quickly as 22 months, less than 2 years for what he did. Of course, I'd have given him an extra 2 years for that ostrich skin coat. I'm sorry. I just can't get used to it. Anyway, this judge shopping happens all the time in the criminal justice system. I do not know. See, because, you know, some people will come to you and act like, you know, make certain pronouncements and act like they know. I don't. I do not know. But I do know that this guy Ellis's public pronouncements would make him a perfect judge to hear a case like Paul Manafort's, where even if he's found guilty, a guy who doesn't like federal sentencing guidelines would give him less time, which is, in this case, absolutely what happened. Now, it's interesting that one lawyer who commented on this sentence said that his client was offered 36 to 72 months, that's 3 years to 6 years, in prison for stealing $100 out of a laundry room. $100 out of a laundry room. I will leave it to you to guess the race or ethnicity of that particular alleged miscreant. All over America, folks, and this is the important part, all over America, people convicted of nonviolent crimes are doing much, much longer in the clink than Paul Manafort. Now, all right, if you assume for a moment you want to keep violent criminals off the street, I certainly do. I argue with progressives a lot of times in saying, listen, I am not a supporter of any kind of police brutality, misconduct, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. However, I can tell you this as someone who knows people who have been the victims of violent crime. And one of the things they will tell you is that if a criminal will shoot a civilian on the street, or if a criminal will, for example, shoot at a cop, never mind whether he hits him or not, what do you think they're going to do with you? They're going to shoot you if that's what they're of a mind to do. So I hold no truck with violent criminals. But nonviolent criminals being given, you know, long time, while at the same time, this guy could be out in 22 months, it boggles the mind. And many, if not most, of the people in America convicted of nonviolent crimes who are doing as much time, if not more, than Paul Manafort are people of color. You cannot escape it. Paul Manafort's sentence should outrage everyone who say they have a concern about mass incarceration. We hear a lot about mass incarceration lately. We hear about how the criminal justice system literally chews people of color up and spits them right back out. Again, for nonviolent crimes. Okay? It was an open secret when I was a young man. It was an open secret in New York that, you know, you want to pad your record as a cop, bust some people for weed. It wasn't difficult. And people ended up doing time. There were people that did 5 to 10 years in Texas for possessing a joint, for God's sake. Long time ago. I assume they're out. But the bottom line is, these things have changed over time. But the one constant is the mass incarceration. The one thing that people can count on, whether they're people that run prisons from New York to California, they can count on people in large numbers being locked up. Now, the numbers in certain places, like New York, has declined recently. But the bottom line, against all that, Paul Manafort's lowball sentence looks even more egregious. Even more egregious. Now, some of you who, you know, I tend to be New York-centric because I followed New York politics and many other things in the greatest city in the world, for my money, for a very long time. There was a young man by the name of Kalief Browder who was arrested and locked up in New York City's Rikers Island. He was locked up there for better than 3 years. And it turned out he was innocent. He went through pure D hell, getting beat up by inmates, getting beat up by COs allegedly. I mean, it was the whole nine yards. He got out of prison and ended up killing himself. He will have done almost as much time as Manafort was sentenced to, and quite possibly more time than Manafort will serve in prison. And he was innocent. They accused him of stealing somebody's backpack, and then the guy turned around and said, oh, no, it wasn't him. So you can imagine how outraged people were about that. Well, when it comes to our, there's nothing can be done about Paul Manafort. He's going to do his time. He's going to get out. He says his professional reputation has been ruined. Okay, fine. Whatever. You have to start looking at the system that metes out wildly unequal justice all across this country. Because if you don't, you risk raising a generation of people with no respect for the law, no respect for the norms of the country. Because you, in order for the country to function properly, the law must be consistent. And in Paul Manafort's case, that's a joke. It is a straight up joke. And I'm going to tell you something. These disparities are absolutely unacceptable. And anyone, and I do mean anyone, seeking elected office in America should say so. But they won't unless we make them. They won't do it unless somebody says, you know, if you don't, if you can't speak up about this, why should I go to the polls and vote for you? There are some candidates who have spoken out on mass incarceration. There are candidates who have spoke out about social inequality and inequalities in the justice system. And I salute each and every one of them. But the bottom line is, it is time. It is past time for people to get something done. This has been a really one thing about Donald Trump's presidency, and I don't thank him for this, but I think it's true. There has been a can-do spirit among progressives in this country that have seen a number of things take place that even folk that ended up supporting them thought was a pipe dream just a few years ago. And hopefully those things will keep pushing. Well, fixing the justice system is one of them. And, you know, they've done some reforms. They've nibbled around the edges. It needs a radical reformation. And if Paul Manafort's lightweight sentence does anything, hopefully it will put a spotlight on those who don't get the break that he got. We're going to take a break, speaking of which, and we're going to come back, and our final topic today is about cash. That's right, cash money. So stay with us. It's The Intersection. Glad you're here. Welcome back to The Intersection. My name is Mark Riley. Our final topic today is about, no, it's not about R. Kelly. It's about cash. Cash money. Have you noticed that you, wherever you are, whatever your situation in life, are you using more and more plastic where back in the day maybe you used to use cash to pay for transactions, to pay for your day-to-day expenses? In other words, are you in the process of going cashless? I think most people in America, compared to when I was young, are carrying and using less cash. Well, one city is fighting back. The city of brotherly love, Philadelphia, just passed a bill banning stores from going cashless. Law won't apply to businesses like parking garages, stores with membership models like Costco, or transactions that require security deposit like rental cars. But in July 2019, all stores in Philadelphia will have to give customers the option to pay with cash. Now, any of you who may have a dollar or two in your pocket can look on the bill, and it says it's legal tender. But to some, that matters not or very little, because there are places, and there are places certainly in New York City and in other cities around the country, that are cashless. In other words, you can't walk into a particular restaurant or a particular establishment, and some of these are chain stores, by the way, and pay with greenbacks. You got to use a card. Now, maybe the problem with this ought to be obvious, but we should say that, for example, the state of Massachusetts has had a ban on cashless stores since 1978, and there are other efforts around the country at both the city and state level. The reason why people are pushing back against a cashless society is, and I think it's kind of simple, actually, they feel that some stores that are refusing to accept cash are discriminating against poor and low-income customers. Others who oppose laws like Philadelphia's say that modernization like this is the wave of the future, and Amazon apparently told Philly they might not open a Go store in that city as a direct result of this bill. See, because there are certain companies, certain firms that are leading the charge toward going cashless. And, you know, for me, it's always been like, what is the benefit to the consumer versus the benefit to the company? All right. I don't really care if Jeff Bezos has a tea time or not. And, you know, since he's the wealthiest, second wealthiest, whatever wealthiest man in the country, it is of no concern to moi. There was a time I would walk right out of a place that said, we don't take cash. And there are a few places like that. It's like you call a restaurant and you want a takeout order and tell them, no, sorry, you have to go on the website. Well, no, I'm not going to patronize your store if I can't call and place an order. Call me old school. Call me fuddy-duddy. Call me whatever you want, but that's just the way I am. And I feel as though this whole cashless revolution is part and parcel of a move toward efficiency and profit for companies, but not necessarily beneficial or of benefit to consumers, to the people that are actually paying the bills, whether they pay for it with plastic or not. What Amazon has done, by the way, has been to encourage people to open accounts, which, of course, you know, they give you a plastic card or whatever to use rather than use cash. And you know, some of these people will tell you, well, you know, the cash is, it's prone to theft. Cash is this, it's inconvenient, it's that. But, like, they don't say it's inconvenient to the customer, because if the customer was inconvenienced by using cash, they wouldn't have any. And I understand that, you know, a lot of people prefer to use cards. People feel they're safer because they don't have to worry about somebody putting a gun to their head and say, give me your money. I do understand that. However, the flip side is there's nothing stopping a criminal from putting a gun to your head, making you go to an ATM and withdraw every nickel you have in it, in your bank account. Happens all the time. The other part of this that is troubling to me is the notion that not everybody has a bank account. You know, we in America, once we have something, whether it's the internet or smartphones or whatever, we tend to think, well, if I got one, everybody must have one. The fact of the matter is, nothing could be further from the truth. I talked to some people recently, and I said to them, because it was about business, I said, listen, why don't you just, you know, text me your email account, and I'll get right back to you, and we'll get this thing done. And they said, no, no, I don't have an email account. I don't have I can't text. I don't have a smartphone. And I'm like, and suddenly it hit me over the head that, no, not everybody does. Now, there are people who don't by choice. They opt out of this whole cashless, you know, email-based, et cetera, society because they feel it has no soul. And you may think I'm joking, but I'm not. There are people who believe that with every fiber of their being. I know them. But for a lot of folks, and see, the other part of it is, you know, these things cost money. When you give somebody a card and tell them to use it in lieu of cash, I guarantee you somebody's getting paid who wouldn't get paid if you just paid cash. Something is going on. Somebody's taking a transaction fee or whatever, which is why a lot of people don't like bank accounts. You know, they've kind of tried to regulate it a little bit, but a lot of these banks, not all, but a lot of these banks, they make out like, they make literally billions of dollars every month on transaction fees, late fees, this fee, that fee. They can make up a fee if there's a problem trying to get the money. And I think that to an extent, this whole cashless thing is kind of an offshoot of that. It's kind of representative of a change in the society. Now, there are going to be people, techies, whoever, who will argue, well, you know, you're really talking about the transition from the horse to the car. Once the internal combustion engine was invented and people started figuring out ways to create automobiles, that spelled the end of horse transportation. And it certainly did. It absolutely did. And nobody's saying we need to go back to the days of horses and buggies. That's not what anybody says. But I'm not sure this is quite the same thing. Let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. I, being of a certain age, used to love going to delicatessens near my job, wherever my job was, and getting certain kinds of sandwiches that, you know, they would put the meat in the slicer and slice it up and put it on bread, and you could see the guy do the whole thing, the deli guy behind the counter. My particular weakness was fresh, off-the-bone turkey, which wasn't in every deli in New York, but there were a couple of places there. It was just so delectable. And the thing is, it would go, they would put out a turkey breast at like 11 o'clock in the morning. It'd be gone by 1 because everybody, you could smell it walking in the door. And those kinds of delis, little by little, have begun disappearing. They've been replaced by, in many cases, chain stores. And I don't have a beef per se with chain stores. Don't get me wrong. Don't get it twisted. But they've been replaced by stores who have a variation on the following. They have their sandwiches made in a central location. They have trucks that deliver the sandwiches to the particular outlets. And then they sit on a shelf all day until a customer comes and snatches it up. And you know, you all know the kinds of stores I'm talking about. And it dawns on me. And it's interesting if you look at some numbers. Now, this is not my number. This is a number from the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, who's supposed to know about these sorts of things. They say that 6.5% of all Americans, or not all Americans, of U.S. households do not have a bank account. That means that the doors of cashless stores are closed to 6.5% of American households. Now, you might want to make the argument that, you know what, I'll cater to that 6.5% and I might be able to make a profit. I might be able to make a living for myself. I saw this also. It's not just with sandwiches. It happened with banking too. I'm not sure how prevalent this is, so maybe I shouldn't say it, but there are places where you go and for like $2, they will cash your payroll check. And they're never empty, never, ever empty. And you might ask yourself, why would somebody use one of those places if they have a bank account? The answer, they don't have a bank account. And they trade in cash. And I understand that for some businesses, cash is a problem because it's easy to steal. It's easy to just, you know, $1 for me, $1 for you. I fully understand that. I remember the days when, you know, there were nightclubs all over the country, in fact, who got in deep doo-doo over stashing cash and lowballing their income. But I just think that there ought to be provisions for people to pay with cash. I just do. I don't know whether I'd support a law. We've got an awful lot of laws in this country. But I think that there ought to be a provision made for people to pay with cash. Now, the other side of this is people are resourceful. People who pay cash are also resourceful. If they can't get what they want through a cashless store, they'll go someplace that accepts cash. Trust me, they will. It's just that I understand and to an extent empathize with the city of Philadelphia that doesn't want to see the entire city become cashless so that, you know, nobody can pay with legal American tender. We need to keep emphasizing that. The money that we have, backed by the resources of the federal government, of course, that is supposed to be able to pay for things. And when you create a cashless situation, you are actually disengaging people from participating in a process that's been around forever. Forever. In America, anyway. I mean, I know, you know, there was days back in, you know, Confederate money and all the rest of that kind of stuff. But the bottom line, we've been paying cash for a long time. I understand people enjoying or liking, for a lot of reasons, including safety, to pay with a card or a swipe thing now. There's a million different ways you can pay. I understand that. I empathize with that. But don't ban paying with cash. I would just say that to retailers generally. To me, it just makes good economic sense because there's no reason to push people out of the door on that level. New York has, and I hate to keep referencing New York, but New York has a bunch of restaurants. You cannot pay cash. They don't even cash register. We don't have one. It's as simple as that. You want to eat here, you got to have a card. Now, I also understand that for some people, sounds like rank discrimination on its face. I understand that. But at some point, there's going to be a reckoning about this sort of thing. And, you know, if people aren't careful, there are going to be more cities like Philadelphia that simply say, no, you cannot not accept cash. I want to thank everyone who has taken the time and made the effort to download this podcast. It's called The Intersection. My executive producer is Ms. Kim Jack Riley. What action are you getting ready to take for the 2020 election here in the great U.S. of A? Whether you agree with me or disagree with me, let's have the conversation. Post your comments on my Facebook page at Mark Riley Media. It is a situation where I invite people I disagree with. Always have. Because I'm no Einstein. I don't know everything. But until we meet again, please be well.